from tragedy to triumph.
Hey everyone, welcome to another special episode of From Tragedy to Triumph. I'm your host, Aaron Lane, a recovering alcoholic and drug addict that's been clean and sober since December of 2016. Now, I believe that everything that has happened in my life up to that point, including today, has shaped the man that I am. On a daily basis, we hear tragic stories, and our goal here is to present you with amazing success stories of people who have gone from tragedy to triumph. My guest today is Shane Reinert. And Shane, before we get into this amazing story of why you do what you do, why don't you give the listeners an idea of what you're all about?
Okay, I'm all about a video series called The Addiction Series. It started in January 2016. It gives people in recovery a chance to share their stories and in a more relatable way, something I feel like that's kind of real and raw.
So are you yourself in recovery?
I am not. I am allergic to so many different things. I'm allergic to smoke. I'm allergic to alcohol. I've got Crohn's disease, so I'm allergic to dairy, wheat, seeds, spicy food. So I was not somebody who was going to be taking those things on and putting them in my body. I have enough problems.
And, you know, it's funny. Like, I always tell people, or I've heard, like, you know, I have an allergy to drugs and alcohol. I always break out in handcuffs. Or I'm actually allergic to walnuts. In December of 2014, Christmas Eve, I was at the Prospect House. People brought in these walnuts, you know, like gift baskets full of food. And I had never had an issue before. And I'm eating handfuls of walnuts. Next thing you know, I'm falling over in this great hall. The EMTs are there. I start to go blind. I remember being so angry at God that day because I thought I was dying. I was like, if I die as a result of eating whatever I just had, I'm going to be really mad, God, like really mad. Thankfully, that wasn't the case because you know, I'm not a ghost. And you are actually, hopefully you're not a ghost. But so you've started this series and you've had what, over 1 million views now, right?
Over 1 million views. People have watched in 217 countries. And I didn't even know there were 217 countries. The YouTube analytics told me that. And I said, that just blew me away.
Well, yeah, this is a global issue.
Without a doubt. I have people reach out to me from all over the world all the time. I had somebody reach out from the island of Crete one day thanking me for what I'm doing. I had to look up where that was.
Where is it, by the way?
It's right off of like Greece, Italy. There's okay. A little island there. And I thought that's so cool because there's not things like the addiction series over there. I don't think treatment and the way they view things is something that's a lot more public. We're real public here with that issue now.
Well,
we've
become
anonymous.
Public about
yes.
it. Right.
We're not as anonymous as we once were. And I think there's not as many resources in a lot of other countries.
Well, I think that it goes to show on how addiction and recovery have intertwined into our very life itself. And because of the way that the internet works and sharing content, that people anywhere can view that. And that's a really amazing thing to me is that here you're doing something not in recovery yourself, but there's a reason that you're doing this. And it can't, from so far talking to you, I know it wasn't money driven. There's a passion behind that. And we're going to get to why that is. But to rewind the clock a bit, right, I want to have an understanding of what your childhood was like, how we got to here. So what was like growing up for you?
Okay, I grew up in a small town of Amelia, Ohio, just outside of Cincinnati. My parents were together till I was about 12. We split up. I got a younger brother who's 2 years younger than me, and I have a sister who's 5 years younger. My dad, he kind of did everything for us as far as he coached all of our sports teams. Whenever he came home from working, he would swim with all the neighborhood kids and everything. And he really set an amazing example. He was a really hard worker. He painted. He rehabbed houses. He worked
like
really,
a man's man, like Renaissance man type
absolutely.
Of
absolutely. There was nothing he couldn't do. I mean, fixing cars. If there was something wrong in the house, he would be able to fix those things. And he taught us all to work really hard. He told us, nobody's going to work you harder than I've worked you. And it was the truth. Nobody's pushed me as hard as what he did. And so he raised us up, and I graduated high school trying to figure out what to do, just like everybody else. Took a job delivering pizzas, which actually I did for about 5 years. I really
did. You always smell like onions and peppers and everything?
Absolutely. I happened to be in a neighborhood that I did extremely well in. It's actually the best I've ever done financially in my entire life.
As a pizza man?
Yes.
Really?
It just happened to be the right neighborhood. To be able to deliver in.
Kind of like the same neighborhoods that give out full, like king-size candy bars on Halloween.
Absolutely. I mean, I had no idea, but it taught me a lot about how to interact with people and being comfortable with people. Because you can't just go up the door, say, here's your pizza, and not say anything to them and just kind of stare at them.
Well, you
expect
could,
a good tip.
But I mean, exactly, but not expecting a tip.
You had to learn, okay, you know, what have they done to their yard? What kind of dog do they have? How can you interact and build that bond with them? So every time I go there, they're going to remember me. And they're more likely to give a better tip, and I'm going to do well there.
The fact that you even have this thought process, right, is really a cool thing to me. Some people, you know, just show up and, you know, barely do the job that they're asked, right? To deliver a pizza within itself is not a complicated job.
No.
It's like, here, take this to this house, get the money, bring it back, go do another one. But you also have a livelihood that you're looking out for and ways and means in order to get the most out of that job. So really, I mean, I can see early on, you're young. You said you did this for a while. How many
Absolutely.
Years?
I did it for about 6 years.
6 years delivering pizzas. You would have to. I mean, you know, because you don't look like a burnout to me.
No,
like most
no.
of the guys that show up like, sorry, your pizza fell, you know, that type of thing. But no, that's a really cool way. And I think if that, you know, even as a lesson itself, to do the job that you do to your best of your ability. That's a really cool thing. So now this kind of gives me an idea of like what your character is like. And really at a year, you know, this is, you know, what, your early 20s that you were doing this?
I started the day I turned 18.
Okay. So like 24 is like by the time you were done with that. And you were trying to figure out what you wanted to do with your life. And was
Absolutely.
There, besides the pizza thing, what else were you doing?
I was watching a lot more video and television, and the Blair Witch Project came out, and that caught my eye. And I was like, wow, you know, that it wasn't crazy complicated. It wasn't crazy creative.
No,
and I thought, I can do that. And then there was a show dating myself quite a bit called Dawson's Creek, where the main character wanted to be a filmmaker, and it became more and more interesting to me. And the technology was changing where it was becoming affordable to your average person.
Right.
Even more so now than what it was then. And I was fortunate enough to get connected with some people. The church I was attending had been set up, all their video equipment was set up by the guy who was running Channel 9 at the time. So I got to get my hands on some of the state-of-the-art equipment there.
So did you, like, intern with them, or did you physically work?
I volunteered.
Wow.
I volunteered. I would spend, I'd do the Sunday services there. I started out doing slides, and then I was able to use these cameras. They were Sony Betacams, about 50-pound cameras, if they're on your shoulders. At the time, we had something called Avid Media Composer.
Okay, I'm familiar personally.
Non-linear video editing. So I was learning from them, and I was trying to teach myself at the same time, trying to buy equipment where I could spend time. There wasn't a YouTube for tutorials.
No, there wasn't.
You had to like buy DVDs where it was really expensive. So you got the TV going one way, you're looking at the computer the other way, you're stopping and starting, trying to do what they did.
You know, I'm self-taught in a lot of things, like photo editing software, Photoshop. I mean, you know, in terms of, I remember growing up and we didn't have, well, my dad had like high speed internet, which was the most amazing thing when I was growing up because nobody I knew had it. And because of that, it allowed me to open up this world into the internet and to, you know, build computers. My brother Eric and I would, you know, we research and figure out how to make our internet connections faster. And then we're downloading, well, legally things like, you know, Napster and all these, like playing video games, all of that. And most of it was self-taught. And I'm glad that at the time that I was able to learn those things because I was interested in it. And I can see how that's, a, you know, a natural progression. You're like, you have to teach yourself how to do this. And the beautiful thing about education is that, like, you can lose jobs, you can lose this, but you can never lose what you've been taught. So here early on, you're finding something that you're absolutely passionate about outside of the pizza thing, which is fine because you were making money, and that allowed you to pursue this career early on and be surrounded by professionals. And did you find any success with that early on outside of, you know?
I was trying to pick it up as best I could. I tried to find anybody who was producing content anywhere. How could I spend some time, even if I'm not getting my hands on the equipment, watching them? How does this work? Getting any of the behind-the-scenes things you could get on DVDs when they were first starting to come out. You always got those behind-the-scenes looks. It's like, okay, how did they do this? How did they make this look like this? How do they get the sound they get? What type of time did it take? And I was doing everything I could to pick those things up before the internet really got up to high speed. I was dealing with dial-up, so I'm trying to like find books.
Right.
The books is a lot harder to do when you're trying to do a visual medium. It was easier when I could find DVDs and stuff like that on there.
Because you could see it happening as opposed to like writing about it and you're trying to visualize in your head what this is supposed to look like.
So I would watch shows and I'm like, okay, how did I line this up? Trying to get some of my friends to act in some short movies and things like that where I could try to frame things the same way they did it with any equipment I can get my hands on.
What was the first thing that you remember recording and producing? And
outside of doing the church services at the church, I shot something I called the East Fork Project, which was a Blair Witch Project ripoff. I was shooting on a high 8 Sony camera. A friend of mine and I went together in on that. It had a Firewire cord that came out of that.
Okay.
I could plug that into a Sony computer because they developed the technology and tried to edit it from there. I tried, I believe Windows had a Movie Maker thing that was extremely basic. And then Adobe Premiere had just released, I think, its second version, and I bought that. That was extremely expensive.
Yeah. Like, it was so much more expensive to just jump in the game then. Now, as we were talking about beforehand, like, with our cell phones, we can create content, we can edit content, we can post content directly from what we have in our hands. And to be able to start today and do this, you are well at an advantage because of the availability of information and tutorials and technology. But here you're kind of, I mean, it was a time for you of drastic change because you're going from dial-up to high-speed internet to the way that technology increases so much in a short period of time. But this is still before the advent of like a cell phone and just being able to record from there. And now you're really, you know, this is like 1999, I remember, I believe was when Blair Witch Project came out.
Yes.
So then we're, you know, in terms of like, I graduated in the year 2000. I remember how big of a deal that was. And I can see how that could inspire someone like yourself to say, well, if they can do it, I can do it. Right.
Exactly.
And so did you get any? So do you still have copy of this?
I accidentally taped over that because I was wondering where that was. I said that would have been hilarious. We're recording on little tapes. And then from there, I jumped up to a Canon XL1, which is what they shot the movie 28 Days Later, that zombie movie.
Right.
So I was able to get my hands on one of those cameras used and tried to shoot more stuff. Try to get better, try to learn more about what I needed to do to become professional and continue doing the church services. We were sending those out to public access TV stations and things like that. So I was getting an opportunity to
direct. You've
been
doing this for a while now.
To edit, shoot, and then I was trying to do things on my own time with my own equipment. Whenever I could get any of my friends to sit still long enough, hey, just right. Pretend like you're scared right now or something like that. And I continued to do that. And then I ended up going to Wexner Center for Arts up in Columbus to learn a little bit more on the editing end.
Okay.
I got an Avid editing class, 3-day class, and got a certificate, intro to Avid editing. And then from there, I decided I was ready to take on, see if I could grow my skills. So I signed up to go to what is now Ohio Media School. They were
right,
Ohio
so
Center
of
Broadcasting
at the time, right? I'm an alumni from there too, but now, so, you know, not to get like, because I don't want to get off track just in terms of the technical skills you've learned, but you have developed a passion for filmmaking early on.
Absolutely.
And you are trying at different things. Your dad has already instilled in you this idea of working hard, which I think is well established at this point in time. And now you carry this because essentially you've been doing this for 19, 20 years, right? At this point in time.
19 years.
I don't want to die. Right.
19 years.
So you would, I'd consider you an absolute professional in the field in which you do. Now, as time moves forward and, you know, you're a young adult and, I mean, do you get a family at this point in time? Or like, are you, like, what are you doing outside of the film stuff? Like, what's kind of like your day to day?
I had my first son in 2004 and then I started working in the industry after I had graduated. I got my first job working at another access center in Forest Park. I was there a few months. It just wasn't a good fit, and I was driving really far. So I stepped out, and I said, well, maybe I won't end up doing this. So I backed off.
I get that. You get discouraged because you're like, I'm putting all this energy and time and money into this, but it's not happening. I'm not, you know, Steven Spielberg yet or anything like that.
That's it. It was the technology wasn't there, not the way it is now with DSLRs and things like that. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to try to do what I can to provide for my family. And I'm doing all kinds of different jobs. And then one day out of the blue, I'm out working in the yard and I get a phone call. Hey, we'd like you to apply for this Access Center job, which was one of the places the church was dropping off the
So like community access TV.
Yes.
Okay.
So they said, we'd like to have you come in and do an interview. I was like, okay, sure. Yeah. And
I'm nothing else. Like, go right.
Whoa. Okay. So do the interview and I get hired, and I spent from June 2006. I began as a full-time employee until the end of last year when the station quit broadcasting. So I was there all that time. I worked with a lot of great people, learned everything I could. I was super plugged in. We did some really neat documentary style stuff that got some attention and really gave me the bug and made me realize that's the type of stuff I wanted to do. Tell these stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like human pieces, local human reality, you know, inspirational things of that nature. Like what are some of, during that time frame, what were some of what you feel would be the best marks that you've made in this industry? Like the best produced, created content.
We started with Ghost Stories in Ohio. We started in Claremont County. The historian at the time had a really good following, and we were just going to put it on the air. And then somebody said, hey, why don't you make a DVD? So we make that. Next thing we know, we contact Borders Books, which is no longer around, but they were near, and they said, hey, we take all kinds of new products and stuff from local people. We've never done a DVD before. So we talked a minute, and then an article came out because the historian was also worked for a newspaper. So we got an article put out. There was a waiting list of people waiting on this product. So we started going to them with the product, and then we made a second one. The historian had some health issues. He didn't end up participating in the second one. We traveled all around Ohio, and the part of the haunted hotel segments on the Today Show aired part of our footage.
So you're getting big recognition.
We got noticed. We got noticed. They did it without our permission, but
either way, I mean, publicity's publicity, right?
That's it. That's it. So we were like, okay, you know, obviously we must be doing something right. So then we backed off of the ghost. I did one more. The technology had changed. I did one more. It didn't do any good. That door had closed. And then I did the Underground Railroad in Claremont County. I worked with the Freedom Center here in Cincinnati, and some historians got some great information there.
So what have you learned from that? I mean, I know because we have the Underground Railroad, the museum downtown, like
they were great. They were great to work with.
This is a huge part location in Claremont County too. I didn't know that.
Claremont County had a lot going on, especially where I live now in Bethel, Ohio. It was actually, we had one of the biggest abolitionist senators, Thomas Morris. He was one of the first ones to come out and speak against slavery in the Senate. They called him the Lion of the Senate. So I got to pick up a lot of history. We went from the ghost things, and the guy was a historian.
Right.
It was a natural progression into something more serious.
Okay.
And I was just continuing to try to find serious topics because I wanted people to take me seriously. I didn't just want to be the ghost guy forever. I wanted to be somebody.
The Blair Witch, the ghost stories.
Yeah,
I
don't
want to
get labeled.
Like,
I didn't want to get stuck in that niche. And I thought, I don't want to be that guy. So started looking at more things to cover, and continued to crank out community content for the community in Anderson Township. And then I decided I was going to find some stories that really matter to change people's lives, and I couldn't figure out what I was going to do. So I'm hanging out at my mom's. She's always got the news on, and I'm seeing all these people ODing, all these people dying. I keep thinking there's got to be at least one person out there who's gotten better.
Right.
And talked to my wife a little bit, who knew somebody who was in recovery. She got me my first person, and we sat him in the chair, and the story just blew me away. I mean, I was almost in tears by the end of it. And I kept thinking to myself, if it affected me that way, how is it going to affect somebody whose family's been affected by addiction, who maybe lost somebody? And I thought, I got to keep doing these. These stories really matter. These are really powerful. And that's kind of how I transitioned into the addiction series.
I mean, that's really, you know, I get the natural progression, right? And wanting to do things that have made an impact. But to not be in recovery yourself, and you said you've been allergic your entire life to any type of drug or alcohol and then certain foods. What was that like to allow someone into your home? Let them in your home?
Not the first one. Okay. I was still at the studio down in Anderson Township, so I was able to bring them into the studio down there and, you know, get them comfortable because I didn't know them. I mean, we had never met any of the people before. They just came in and said, you know, we talked, this is what I'm trying to do. You just have you sit in this chair, I'll set up a camera or two, and just tell your story.
And No, and I'm curious to this, right? So to talk to someone as a filmmaker, I get it that you have this natural desire to, I mean, an ability from what you've done to draw things out of people, get them comfortable, like we, you know, having a conversation. But that first time, that first experience, you say being emotional, not having really any reference point, because this is the first person you've really met. This is the first person you're interviewing. And I mean, what was it that made got you to cry, to make you emotional that day? Would you remember what that was?
Well, I know when he started, I started hearing all the things that he had done. And I'm at first I was like, I can't believe this. You know, this is some terrible, terrible stuff. But by the end, he's talking about rebuilding relationship with his mother. He's talking about taking care of his kids. He's talking about how his mom helped him get his house that he's living in.
Right.
And he's talking about all these differences and how bad you really have to want it. And he's tearing up. I'm tearing up. And I'm trying to hold it together because I don't want to ruin the sound. Distracting him. And I just thought, this is so powerful. We're all looking for that redemption story. That's something that we all seem to be so drawn to here in the U.S. I don't know if it's that way worldwide, but here, boy, everybody wants a good story where somebody beat something.
Story. Yeah, in any context, right? And especially the topical nature of how pervasive addiction has gotten into our community in so many areas to show that people actually change. That's the whole reason I'm doing this. Just like you, I mean, you know, look, I've had my own struggles with substance abuse, but outside of that, getting some distance from it and sensing that it's constant bombardment of ugly, terrible things, tragic stories in the news. It's how I start every episode off. I'm tired of hearing that. People do change, and to change this stigma that surrounds the fact that these are human beings, that this is somebody that didn't foresee getting caught up in that. And to be able to show that person compassion and be able to tell their story to encourage someone else to do the same, that if I can do it, so can you. Like, these are very real things. And I have such a way of relating to you as an individual, even though we don't have the same walk of life at all. We're on different sides of the same thing. But it's beautiful to me that there are like-minded people that are trying to make impactful change in the world. So now you have this first person, powerful, powerful interview. You have not experienced that. Do you upload it immediately, or, I mean, what did you, how long did it take you to edit that? You remember?
It was probably a few days, and then I wanted to make sure everybody got a chance to see it before it went public.
Because of what it is, right?
I don't want them to think about, hey, I shouldn't have said this, or this might make my mom mad, or my uncle, or whoever. I wanted them to be comfortable with that, and I wanted to be able to create trust between me and anybody who was going to sit in the chair and tell their story. Because I didn't want them to feel like, well, he just uploaded this thing, didn't even show it to me, and now I don't want this out there.
Right.
Yeah, this is my life.
I know that fear, by the way. Before, a lot of people don't know this, but before I started my show, you know, I did my interview with Axel, who's the program director of 96 Rock. I wasn't as concerned to tell him my story because I am a very transparent person about what's happened at this point in my life. But I knew by sharing this story that my family was going to hear, my ex-wife, my girlfriend, my kid, you know, like my kids haven't yet. But like once it's out, it's out. And I can't come back from that. Do I really want everybody that I know and don't know to understand these specifics of like putting a needle in my arm, running from police, felonies? Like, I mean, I was worried about judgment for it was a strong feeling of fear, but it came to pass because I felt compelled. I had to do it. That this is the reason that I'm in broadcasting is to use my voice to help somebody else and to get more of people like yourself or someone in recovery or on different sides to do the same, because that's what helps heal. And I was like, and I need to heal. This whole thing, you know, I talk about saving a life and maybe it's going to be mine that's saved. I don't know. And that's worth it to me because my children get their dad back, right? So this first person you talked to is now was a good dad. He went through all these ugly things. And I'm sure because of talking to you prior to this, that was a catalyst for you to really believe in recovery as like a real thing and not to judge the addict, not to judge the individual, even though they've done terrible things, right? So was this like, how did this carry into, you know, now you said you're like at 55 shows of that, but like, you know, how, I'm really stunned. I'm shocked and amazed that you do this. And I want to really harness what it is that you're trying to accomplish here.
Well, I felt like we were throwing away all the people based on what I was seeing in the news. We're just throwing away people. And I don't believe there's any throwaway people.
No.
We all deserve another chance. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to give us that chance, but we all deserve that opportunity to get our lives right, to be straightened out, to be able to rebuild those relationships, to be healthy, mind, body, soul, spirit, and to be able to share those stories that it can happen, that somebody out there has maybe done the exact same things to an extreme detail that you wouldn't imagine, say, I can't get better. Well, here's somebody who did the exact same thing, and now you know you can. That excuse is gone. You got to look in the mirror and say, okay, if this person did it, I can do this.
Right.
And that was the big motivation. I started getting people commenting that, hey, I did the exact same thing. You know, congratulations. I'm going to try to follow after you. I'm going to try to do the same thing you did and get my life together. And it kept building and building and building. And then sometimes I get comments where it's like, this is keeping me clean. I watch this every day. It's keeping me clean.
That's reward within itself. You're like, you're not making any money off this.
Zero. All the equipment at this point, once the station quit broadcasting, I was in prayer mode and I said, if you want me to do this, God, I need the equipment. And I had somebody come in a few days later with a check.
Dude.
And I hadn't even told them. I hadn't told anybody. And that was just
crazier
amazing.
Things have happened. I know I've prayed before, and all of a sudden some members was like, okay, that sign is quite bright and blaring.
Absolutely.
So you were able to get your equipment. Somebody
came in, said, hey, here's a check. What do you need to get? Is this enough? And I said, well, let me price everything out and we'll go over this stuff.
No, it's not.
I must have said, are you sure 100 times? Because it's nothing like that's ever happened to me. You hear it happen to other people, and I was just like, are you sure you really want to do this? Said, absolutely. We believe in what you're doing. So I was able to get the equipment, and then after the station quit broadcasting, I made a few home visits, people I hadn't met before, going to their house, telling the stories.
Right.
And then I've met, there's an MAT recovery group here in Cincinnati.
Which is medically assisted treatment.
Yes, medically assisted treatment. They found a location where we could shoot out in Norwood, which is right down the street. So I started recording there, and then I have people call in from all over the country. Sometimes people will travel. I've had people travel from Texas to here to share their story, Florida from here, out on the East Coast, they've driven here. Or sometimes they just want to come and hang out. And I was like, are you serious? You just want to hang out? It's like, yeah, I'll spend the day with you hanging out.
And you could have never foreseen this. I mean, you've had a career for a while, and working this local access capacity and doing different things. But this, and to have a passion to share stories of amazing stories of hope, a lot like what I'm doing, has, you know, snowballed into something that is, looks like it's, well, you know, it's bigger than you. It's bigger than me. You're a part of this. I'm a part of this. But I mean, I'm thoroughly impressed with that. I think that's a really cool thing in the to it, because you genuinely want to help and show that it's possible. Now, in the process of doing this, though, have you run into the, like, people that you've interviewed that have maybe gone back out or lost their lives or anything like that?
I've had two people struggle with relapse. One is still battling issues with alcohol. Another one, he relapsed, and it was a very public relapse. He was really out there trying to get people to understand his story and everything, and he relapsed around his birthday, and that was hard. I stayed in touch with him because he was getting eaten up on social media, and I said, do not get on social media.
Just disengage completely.
I said, you know, I still believe in you. I trust that you're going to get better. And he's working in a recovery center in Florida now.
Okay.
And so nobody's died. I've been fortunate that all the people have done pretty well. I've only had two out of all the people lose their lives. And
I mean, like, that have gone back out. They haven't lost their lives.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody died, but somebody died. Okay.
Yeah. So
good.
I've only had two people relapse.
Okay.
Nobody has died on that end. And, you know, I've interviewed some parents as well when I first got started who lost their kids. So I'm holding a mom who had just lost a son, and she wanted to tell her story, but she wasn't ready for it.
Well, it's not easy.
I had a dad who lost two of his sons. Come in there. I've had groups, and those are really hard to tell too.
I was gonna say, how do you prepare for something like that?
I know it's not going to be easy. I know that it's going to be heavy, heavy, heavy. But I try to have people there that they're comfortable with, so they've got somebody to lean on, because they're not always going to go to me. And if they do, I'm a stranger in a lot of ways to them, but I'll be there for them if they want me to be there. So I tried to cover those, but for the most part, I've stayed on people in recovery, because those other ones are pretty heavy to do.
No,
that all
and
time.
I get that. I mean, because really, you're trying to share a story of hope, and I think you know, even for the show that I'm doing and interviewing you or interviewing Tom Sinan, or you know, I'm going to be having a physician coming on next. I'm trying to show recovery from every angle of not only the individual, but the person like yourself, of why you do what you do, why you are so passionate about sharing these stories, why a cop continues to champion for, you know, the recovery community. And in something like that, even last night, I was the master of ceremony for the Parents of Addicted Loved Ones Midwest Conference. And I had an opportunity. My mom was there. My mom, for many years, had prayed and asked God, like, please fix my son, or please don't let him be in pain anymore. I mean, that's a tough thing as a mom to even just like to look at her son and just to, you know, to be so hopeless and helpless that he might not make it. And there are many people just like my mom that are at this convention, hundreds of mothers and fathers and brothers that are either dealing with a loved one that's still out there using or that had passed away. And here I am on the stage, right, talking to a panel of professionals in their field from law enforcement, medical community, education, and I am the recovering addict in the room. And they have the ability to look at my mom and the joy on her face. You know what I mean? Like, that's a hugely powerful, amazing thing to me. But to also recognize that the women in that audience may not be experiencing that. Maybe their loved one still is out there. To respect that and to show them that there's hope. Like, I'm just a hope shot, and there's so many people like myself, but the gratitude that I had to be able to do this and connect with this huge group of people to show them that it's possible is overwhelming. I can't even, look, I talk for a living, and it's hard for me to put that feeling into words. And I'm eternally grateful, so I'm grateful for what you do too, and to talk to these different people and stuff like that. And now, where does this go, though, for you? Like, what do you foresee? Because it's already gotten to the point with a million views. Collectively? Either way. Yeah. Okay, so a million people have viewed Change in a Story of Hope, right?
Absolutely.
And that's a huge milestone. My show, I mean, while it is, I mean, I have, that's well down the line if it even ever happens. My goal is to just get as many people following as we lost due to overdoses in last year, 70,235. That's my goal, because I want to show that tragedy can be a triumph. We can turn that around. But where do you see this happening? Like, you know, what is your plan for this year?
This year, I'm trying to get the word out even more than I have before through different media outlets, and trying to show people that, okay, this exists. You do still see a lot of television shows, a lot of documentaries still focusing on people who have relapsed.
Right.
There's still not enough coverage of people in recovery who are staying clean and how they did it. I've hired a PR firm that's helping me try to pitch some ideas to some different networks and things like that. The addiction series continues. I have people reaching out from all over the world. Hey, when's the next one coming out? When can I get more? I've created a monster. There's just so many people who want that. I have treatment professionals saying, hey, we use this here. I had somebody comment on one of the videos say, I saw this in jail before I got out. They're showing some of this stuff in jail. I had no idea. And I still have people say, you have no idea how many people you're reaching. And I think to myself, well, I got the YouTube analytics. I have a pretty good idea. But then I found out.
Not that person, though. That's the beautiful thing, is that you're on an individual level, somebody that says, I watched this and it made an emotional impact on me, and I'm going to change my life and have changed my life.
Absolutely. I get comments like that all the time. I'll have, I had somebody reach out from India. I've had people reach out from Ghana. I found out that they were actually broadcasting some of the episodes in Ghana, Africa. I had no idea. That just blew me away. I have people reaching out saying, hey, this helped me understand my child better. Hey, I'm using this every day to stay clean. I actually had somebody call me. I put my phone number out there just in case anybody
Big
needed.
Mistake, homie. No, I'm kidding.
Just if somebody was comfortable reaching out, hey, you know, okay, right. So I didn't answer. I didn't recognize the area code. And they left a message, so I call them back. And the guy says, hey, my name's George. I live in this small town in Kansas. You saved my life. And he's like, I'm sure you get this call all the time. I was like, what?
No, I don't.
What happened? Tell me what's going on. And he said, out where I'm at, there's no recovery places. So I got clean watching your stuff, reading my Bible, and watching Joel Osteen. And he's like, I just had to thank you and tell you to keep doing it. And I was a little discouraged at the time. I had maybe six people no-show me.
Right.
And I was thinking, I don't know if I was going to be able to continue to do it. But then it's those messages like that that keep me going.
I can see that, you know, because it does get discouraging. I mean, the reality is, even in my own life, and we were talking about this briefly before we started, is some days are very tough for me. With how this is, you know, growing and as we said, you know, like a snowball effect to something that is well bigger than me anyway, there are days where in my personal life I struggle in figuring out, okay, how am I going to make ends meet? How am I going to do this? All these other things. Like, life still happens. You still have a family.
Absolutely.
Like, this impact, I'm sure, has some effect on that, both positive and negative, because here you have to leave or to do these. I mean, what is your, I'm sure your wife is supportive, but how has that dynamic changed for you guys?
It's been good. We've had to set some limits where I said, okay, you know, I can't be available all the time to do these.
Because you can't fix everybody too.
That's it. I said, okay, we'll just find one Saturday a month and try to make all those happen then and there. And then I can do the edits in my own time and get that uploaded at home and not as bad to do. When I do the edits, I'm usually not cutting things out. It's just putting the titles and things like that in there to keep it branded and give it that look right. That it's always had. And she's been patient. I did say this year, I said, I'm going to focus more on being around the family. I have to be patient. I have to not try to make all these things happen overnight. Everybody's got a recovery group who would love to work with me. But it's just a matter of, okay, does this make sense?
Yeah, is it the right fit for you as well? I mean, as it stands, you know, you're doing this on your own dime, your own time, involved, like with your life on the line. Why am I rhyming? No, I mean that, though. Like, you are doing all of these things at your own expense and for a great reason. And I wish you nothing but, you know, immense turnaround when it comes to being able to do this and also provide for your family as time moves forward, if that's in the cards. If not, I mean, I'm sure that you're going to continue to do it either way. But I look at it as for these stories to have more of an impact, because there are millions of people. A million is a huge number, right? But we're talking millions of people and the generational gap and things like that. To be able to have somebody to get this out in front of more people will make a level of impact that you could have never fathomed anyway.
That's it. It's absolutely blown me away. And I have a lot of people request, hey, can you come out to North Dakota? Can you come to New York City? Can you come to Florida? And that's where I'm really limited right now. I can't afford to go to all those places.
If you can bring me out there, I'll come.
That's it. That's the point where I'm starting to reach where I feel like, okay, you know, if I'm going to be traveling, I'm going to need some sort of support.
Yeah.
It's not going to work coming out of my pocket. There's no way we can continue to pay the mortgage, keep the cars going.
No, this
and all
is
the
real life
you gotta
stuff.
Do.
Yeah, I mean, this is a passion project for you, and it's made a lot of impact. But the reality is, you're still a dad, a husband, and a provider, so you have that dynamic as well. And you know, as you say, you have a PR firm now. Things are going to be changing a bit. Hopefully, getting in front of the right people so that you can maybe even have a creative team that is involved with this, so that you can take more of the direction approach and say, look, this is what it's supposed to look like, and allow other people to kind of help out in that, I would guess.
That's
right?
It. I'm trying to build those things up. I mean, if I can build some financial backing where we can go and promote this a little bit more and get some more people involved and find some consistent funding, we can continue to grow this and reach out to more people and maybe do some of them live, do different appearances. It would be great to be able to do that type of stuff. And we know it's not just a United States issue. It's a worldwide issue. I mean, it would be great to be able to go around and maybe interview different governments around the world. How do you guys handle this issue? Talk to people who are in recovery, maybe in India, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, and how do they handle that there as opposed to what we're doing here?
It's like a sober movement.
It's a lot more than just these stories. I need to go deeper and I need to go further. because we got to break down those walls. We got to break down that stigma, and we got to get people to let go of that fear of sharing their story. We have to let people know that it's okay. Now, there might be some people who do have some judgment. I do moderate my comments because we live in that internet generation where
people
aren't afraid to put something out there that's the most hateful thing ever. And I refuse to allow that to happen because those are my people. They got there. They sat in the chair. They were honest. They told some of the most deepest, darkest, painful things they've ever been through. And it's my job to protect them because of that. They took a risk, a very big risk. And doing that because an employer can look them up, a future person they would date.
Anybody. For that matter. I mean, look, you know, as I remember telling you many times, and even in my first episodes, like on one end, you look at my resume, it's fantastic. But look at my arrest record. Google my name. You might see a mugshot. I just embrace it today because I'm like, at the end of the day, look, it happened. It's behind me. It is what it is. And there are many other people that have, you know, the same thing has happened to. Even the job that I currently have, I was transparent about it. But I've recognized that me being able to be that way has allowed my life to be more meaningful because now no one can hold it against me. Go ahead. Tell me that, oh my gosh, you were such a hopeless dope fiend. You're right, I was. I'm not today. I'm not. Not that I am fixed by any means, but I'm not doing that. So I think it's a strong encouragement. I think that's a good thing to kind of hit on to tell people is like, look, be real about what's happening in your life, whether it's on an individual, an interpersonal level, or if you are have an ability, you know, with broadcasting or whatever, is champion for this because people need to see that there is hope. Now, Shane, what I'd like to ask is, I think, you know, we've kind of got a great understanding. Like, so where are you currently? You're on Facebook, right? What's your Facebook account for this?
The Facebook account is the Addiction Series. I just recently started that. Now, as Facebook's getting better with the video in, there's still some limitations. It's not quite as flexible as YouTube, but I'm trying to share some of them there where people can share those maybe easier and more likely to be watched in that format because Facebook doesn't have an autoplay feature for the YouTube stuff anymore. They want you to go Facebook native.
They do. Right. They want to keep it within the ecosystem. If they had a podcast hosting platform, I'd throw things up there too. And I am going to share on my my Tragedy to Triumph Facebook page, which is From Tragedy. You search that, it'll come up. I'll be sharing a link to your Addiction Series. Now, you're also on YouTube.
Also on YouTube. The YouTube channel is Shane, S-H-A-N-E, and then the numbers 8109. And people can also email me at shane8109@gmail.com. That's a good way to get me there. Or if somebody wants to call and say, hey, maybe I want to support, maybe I'm really interested in what you're doing, then call me at 513-304-9458. I'm not always available to pick up at the first time, but I do get back with everybody.
Well, there you go. That is absolutely a story from tragedy to triumph. A little bit different, but I want to let people know that there are more resources. Shane, thank you for coming in today. And everybody, make sure and follow Shane's Addiction Series, as well as check us out on Facebook at From Tragedy. Check it out. New episodes coming soon. And as always, do big things.